This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
E-commerce isn't just about having products that people can buy. They want to know, like, who's on the other side of the store.
A social media strategy that flows from your objectives.
So that's how we saw the most success, was doing kind of targeted research and then...
No, you've got to stop interrupting.
Welcome to another edition of the Simon Dell Show. It is Monday, the 23rd of April. Thank you very, very much for tuning in today. Now, on today's show, we have a gentleman by the name of Connor Gillivan, who is an expert at two things. Well, he's an expert at a lot of things, but mainly the reason I got him on is he's an expert at selling on Amazon, which is something that a lot of people are doing. A lot of people are certainly in Australia with the fact that Amazon has actually only arrived in Australia last year, back end of last year. Something that a lot of people in Australia are starting to consider, but a lot of people have been doing throughout the world, the US, UK, for a long time. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to selling on Amazon. He also knows what he's talking about when it comes to selling from an e-commerce perspective, drop shipping, creating viable, successful e-commerce businesses. I only had an hour with him. It's a bit of a shame because there's probably at least 3 or 4 hours worth of knowledge that he has, but definitely worth listening to, because if you're running an e-commerce business or you're thinking about running an e-commerce business, even if you're not running either of those and you're just running a business that's reliant on traffic to the website, he is a mine of information. So listening to what Colin's got to say, I think you'll learn something. The spin cycle this week, we talk about a decision that was made earlier this week by Wetherspoons, who are a UK pub chain, to stop using social media, delete all their social media accounts. Fascinating conversation, fascinating idea that they don't feel that social media is a useful tool for them anymore. So you can hear what Patrick and Eddie have both got to say about that. Finally, obviously, credits for the show, the podcast boss Gilberto and his Colombian friends are there is no Colombian friends, it's just Gilberto. But Gilberto keeps complaining that I make him sound like he's some sort of mercenary Colombian drug lord, which is far from the truth. He's a very nice guy. So please go and see the Podcast Boss website, which you'll find in the show notes. Come and talk to me, simondell.com or simon@simondell.com. If you want to email me, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, you'll find me on all those platforms. And finally, please rate and review us. Go on to iTunes, give us the number of stars that you think we're worth, which we would obviously appreciate it being 5. And if you get a chance to write a review as well, that would be good. So without further ado, we will jump in and see what the kids at the Spin Cycle have got to say. Welcome to another edition of the Spin Cycle. And with me are my two wonderful co-hosts, the pinstriped suit of co-hosts, Dr. Edwina Luck from QUT, and the footy shorts with no underwear of co-hosts, Patrick Condren from Channel 7.
I got to tell you, I don't mind going commando in the but I don't wear footy shorts.
I can't see you in footy shorts. I think you'd be a tracksuit guy.
What, in the middle of summer in Brisbane? I'd be a very thin tracksuit. God, because I would have lost all the weight.
I've got my tracky pants on now.
Oh, right, okay.
The footy shorts with no underwear thing is something that is a cultural, from an Englishman moving to Australia, is probably one of the biggest cultural shocks that you struggle to get over.
Because it happens here or it doesn't happen?
No, because it happens here. It doesn't happen at home.
It happens too often.
Can you imagine anyone in the UK sitting there without any underwear on, wearing a pair of silky footy shorts?
Yes, I can actually.
I can, yes.
About all of those footy games that you go watching at the pub, Pat, you would definitely agree with me. There was.
I've been to both the Stadium of Light in Sunderland to watch a premiership game, And I've been to, what's the one in Newcastle upon Tyne? St. James's Park.
Yes, that's the one.
To watch Premiership football. And I can tell you that for the vast majority of punters attending those stadia, silky footy shorts with no undies on would be a sartorial step up.
It'd be a ritual, wouldn't it?
Apologies for anybody from Sunderland and Newcastle who happen to be listening to this. On that note, Patrick.
We're in the UK, yes.
Yes.
Well, we're going to stay in the UK.
You've been drinking your milk this week, haven't you?
I have been drinking my milk, but particularly from the British Milk Council. I came across this last night on social media and I was intrigued and amused. So there's an account on Twitter called the British Milk Council. And the first post.
Buy British milk. That's what it is.
It is, absolutely.
The handle. So, just wanted to clarify.
Okay, thanks.
Cheers,
thanks,
Ed.
Back to you.
Thanks, Ed.
Yeah, good. Yeah, righto. Well, let's Ed get back to her footy shorts with no undies on and I'll continue on.
No problem.
Oh, no, she was the pinstripes, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Do you wear underpants with pinstripes?
Oh, anyway.
No. Anyway, at Buy British Milk, the first posts that were just being called into the office to be told that British Milk Council are shutting down all social channels. I'm out of a job. Something about misuse of data higher up. F that, it says. I've changed the password and they're not having the account back. And then in capital letters, someone's responded by saying, Jason, log out of this account now or I'll contact Twitter support. To which he replies, Donna, you fucking pie. No, Donna, you're a fucking pie. Can't even keep your own Twitter account secure. Never mind customers' data. Full stop. Shit show of an organisation. And on it goes.
Classic.
Too little, too late, Donna. 3 years I worked my ass off of British Milk Council. I built the brown from the ground up. The man milk promotion, my idea. You don't deserve my man milk, Donna. And it's had, it has had 12,055 retweets, 21,618 likes, and 732 replies. Now, it must be said, this account, the at Buy British Milk, only has 14,000 followers.
There you go. That's
so some, it's an extraordinary, and it is a parody account, and it's completely made up.
Which was disappointing when I found that out, because my question is, how much more milk do you think they've actually sold than any other proper body representing British Milk?
Well, their bio says that they're an official authority promoting the drinkage of milk through exclusive brand content in the UK.
There you go. So it did take a few people a while to understand that it was a parody account. There was a lot of people actually were messaging them, I saw, with advice on how to get the account back from Jason. And I use Jason in air quotes there.
And probably offering Donna a job too, because obviously she built the brand up.
Well, Jason wanted it. Jason said she didn't deserve his man milk.
I
don't know what that means, but it doesn't sound wholesome in any way, shape, or form. Can I tell you something similar sort of happened for Channel 7 once, where a disgruntled former employee who still had access to Twitter, the official Twitter account, this is many years ago, started posting stuff on Twitter, and the bosses made the decision to shut the account down and delete everything and start from scratch.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because that often happens when I was doing some reading about sort of this, and it often happens when a new creative or a new social media manager comes online for comes into an organisation for a brand, they often delete the old posts, which, I mean, you sort of go, well, does that mean all your hashtag, insert brand here, whatever it is that you're looking for, that means the data's gone, or have you saved it somewhere, or is it, you know, I wonder why a social media manager would want to do this. I mean, you want history. You want brand history. You want social media data. So, yeah, it's interesting.
There was another person got sacked this week as well. I don't know whether you saw that from the Daily Mail. Yes. For calling
speaking the truth.
Well, absolutely, calling one of the Bachelor contestants a vapid or vapid, depending on how you want to pronounce that, C-U-N-T. Mm. And that's not the Northern Territory that we're all
holding. No.
And unfortunately, got fired for it, which I think is a bit of a shame.
Because it's the only decent thing that's ever been on the Daily Mail website, it must be said. And yes, it would have lifted their readership among, free thinking and normal people significantly.
The interesting thing about the milk one, which was the obviously probably the main topic for discussion tonight, was that it was done a couple of hours after JD Weatherspoon, the pub group in the UK with 900 odd pubs, I believe, actually announced that they were going to shut down all their social media channels, everything, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, the lot. I just wanted to kind of get your feedback as to whether you thought that was a good move. I don't know if either of you ever been in a JD Weatherspoon. I'm sure you have, Pat. If you've been,
absolutely,
in Newcastle or Sunderland, they're all JD Weatherspoons.
That's exactly right.
Do you think that's a good idea? That number one, that these guys in particular have abandoned social media, and number two, is it a sign of the times for other brands to do the same?
Why did they decide to get out of it?
They haven't really given much of insight as to why.
I mean,
they've made an announcement.
It's easy. You go back to marketing 101 basics, and you guys know this. Look at, and so do our listeners, look at your target market and your customers. Are they active in this space? They obviously weren't. They're providing, JD Weatherspoons are providing a specific solution. And what brand position do they want to hold and achieve? I mean, research suggests that social media use can lead to, a lot of conspiracy theories, damage reputation. You know, social media isn't free. And a lot of these the managers, they didn't have time. They did not have time to post things, and they weren't employing someone who was dedicated to their social media feeds.
But that in this day and age, to me, is mind-boggling. When you look at media companies, for example, Channel 7, Channel 9, the ABC, everything is going online. It is all moving. It's all migrating to online. All the content is moving to online. And the amount of promotion that we do is via social media. So if there's a breaking story, for example, we want to be first to tweet it. We want to get it on Instagram. We want to get it on Facebook. So for an organization like this to say that we're not going to be on social media anymore, and you can't tell me that they don't have a target audience on social media. The vast majority of people that go to pubs are young people who were brought up with social media. So
yeah, but they've changed, Pat. They've changed. They don't check in anymore. In fact, no one checks in. They don't post as much as what they used to. They might use Instagram because they'll post a great photo of themselves with their,
But this bloke said he was getting off off Instagram as well.
Yeah, I just don't think – there's a couple of things I was going to add to this. I don't think Weatherspoons is a place that needs to have people having a social conversation online about them. They're very simple. They're not particularly,
good.
They're a fairly two-dimensional brand. Serve beer, cheap food. That's it. The second thing I was going to say is that there has been in the last, last year, I think it said there was a 24% drop in the interaction rate on Facebook. So Eddie's, very true. Lots of people are using Facebook a lot less. But what I read on Sky News, and again, that's almost as bad as reading the Daily Mail, but and I say that as a non-left wing voter. They seem to think that it was because social media was being used for trolling of MPs and ethnic minorities, and they felt that it was a bit of a swamp, and that they didn't want to be part of it anymore. So whether that's true, whether it's a cost-saving exercise.
There is also, how much does it really cost anyway? But
The reality
was that the company, the chain, the pub chain, has certainly put plenty of effort into it. Until now, they had hundreds of different Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts, but apparently none had won much of a mass following.
Right. Yeah.
Well, they weren't integrated.
And that those who were running the particular accounts weren't doing a very good job about it, according to the BBC. So, in fact, one example they use on the BBC story about this is that a tweet pushing fish and chips on Good Friday got just 3 retweets.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, I can see, and I lay London to a brick that they will, Weatherspoons will get back on social media, but it will be a much professional effort. So instead of having hundreds of different accounts, maybe they'll have one account, run it properly, get a following and go from there.
They need to follow me.
It is a big challenge.
Totally integrated, but.
Yeah, it is a big challenge, especially when you are on a big group or a franchise group. And I remember years and years ago, I got asked to give some advice to one of the Cold Rock ice cream franchisees down on the Gold Coast. Right. And I went in there and they said, oh, this is earlier days of social media, earlier days of Facebook. And they said, oh, we want to do our own social media and, you know, we want to help setting it up and what should we be putting on it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of went, well, they're a big chain now. They were a big chain then. And I'm sort of going, isn't there anyone in head office that's got a central Cold Rock account? And it just seemed that the head franchise and their team were totally disinterested in creating this.
Oh, that's sad.
So what they end up with is exactly what Weatherspoons have got, which is this disparate network of small pages that might have, you know, 150 followers each.
Yeah.
Having said that, according to the figures here, that the actual main Weatherspoons account did have 100,000 followers. So
maybe maybe that's what you do. Maybe you just shut everything down, like Seven was forced. Well, didn't have to do, but what Seven chose to do. So instead of having, you know, all piecemeal stuff, shut it all down.
Yeah.
Let it all go, and then start from scratch. But start from scratch today with today's technology and today's view of the world.
Yeah.
But I disagree with you, Pat. I'm sorry, but
don't apologize about disagreeing.
Unless you
anyone can disagree with Pat, they don't have to apologize.
Unless you have a social media
default setting.
No, I haven't disagreed with you every week, but unless you have
I see. Did you like the blue skies yesterday? Oh, they weren't blue, she said.
No, I don't. I'm not a black and white person, but unless you have a social media strategy that falls and or flows from your objectives and your brand position, there is no point in going onto social media. And I will give you an example.
Yes, but what I'm saying, Edwina, sitting there commando style in your pinstripes, you've got to stop interrupting them. What you're saying, you eradicate you shut down all the social media stuff. You shut it all down, and then you hire social media people. That's what I mean by building it up again, starting from scratch. You put a proper policy framework in place and start from scratch. So I disagree with you.
I think you two are actually agreeing with each other.
Yes, I think so too.
You're both saying exactly the same thing.
Yes. Well, I'm saying it better.
I'm trying to be argumentative for the sake of being argumentative.
True, true. As a final question, though, do you think that there are some brands and some probably industries that shouldn't be on social media? Because
the royal family.
Well, see, I think they'd bloody kill it. They would just have so many followers, it would be ridiculous. So
3,537,670.
Okay, thanks for saying that. So I was looking for
an electric. That's true. I'm just looking at it right now.
My friend has said, I needed an electrician this week. So I went online and my electrician has a Facebook account and I thought, why has he got a Facebook account? His website's pretty dodgy, but and it needs help. But he does not need a Facebook account. So
I agree. Yeah, there's single tradies like that who don't have the capacity to produce content should not be on Facebook. It boils down to this: is that if a brand can produce genuine, worthwhile content that people are interested in, then they should be doing social media. If they can't, or if there's any kind of ambiguity in it, i.e. if they stop for, you know, they stop doing something for, you know, 3 months or whatever, they shouldn't be doing it. It's social media is one of those things you either do, you do and you do well, mm-hmm. or you just don't do. There is no kind of middle ground, because the middle ground looks obvious, like it's a half-assed job.
Yes, absolutely. And can I just say on a final note, Yorkshire Tea has liked my comment about them saying deserved mentions.
Wow.
Lovely.
Mm. It'd be nice if they sent us a care pack or something.
No, you don't go. Actually, you are incorrigible.
Really nice. I think that is
not,
good.
Is that
because,
not what you say?
Well, you just mentioned that, you know, brands producing content, but they need to monitor the conversation, which they are. But now, obviously, Pat, you're an influencer. So, yeah, they need to be nice.
Do you think I'll get free Cold Rock ice cream as well from this episode?
I hope so.
You're unreal. Look at the size of you. You can't fit any more Cold Rock ice cream in.
Oh, my God.
Stop it. Just because it's his birthday week. My goodness.
What do you mean birthday week? It happens on a day.
No, not at our age.
Anyway, thank you very much for both of your time today. It's been one of those episodes where I could have thought of about 100 better things to be doing with my time. But thank you for both of you being here today. And we will see you both next week. I am joined this week by my very first American guest. His name is Connor Gillivan, and he is at the moment sitting somewhere in Denver, Colorado. So welcome to the show, Connor.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me on today.
It's not too bad. How's the weather in Denver at this time of year?
So it's starting to get nicer. It's like spring-ish weather, but it's also a little bit interesting. You'll still get some days where there's some snow, but then the sun comes out and it disappears. So it's, you have some good days, you have some kind of back to the winter days, but it's about to be closer to those summer days, which will be good.
Are you a skier? Are you a winter sports kind of guy?
I'm not a downhill skier, but I do cross country, so I enjoy that and going up to the mountains. I'm definitely more of a summer guy though. I love hiking, love running, love the nice weather.
And it's a nice place for it in Denver to be doing that hiking when the sun comes out.
Exactly. Yeah, there's hundreds of hikes within about an hour's drive, which is great.
Welcome to talk about what you're doing at the moment, because the reason for having you on today is your expertise in e-commerce, which I think if anybody gets a chance to have a look at your website, which is connorgillivan.com, I'll put those in the show notes so everyone can see that and click through. Mm-hmm. But I just want to get an idea about where you started from, because you seem to have done a lot of volunteer work. But the first question I'd kind of like to ask is, what was the first job? And I ask this of everybody, but what was the first job that you ever did in terms of actually getting paid money to do it?
Yeah, my first job was working with one of my cousins, actually. And he was about maybe 8 years older than I. And he, after studying high school and college, he started his own landscaping business.
Right.
So, you know, mowing lawns, cutting hedges, taking down trees, you know, anything to do with a person's lawn. And I started working with him when I was about 14, in the summers when I was out of school and during breaks as well. And, I was way too small to be carrying around big leaf blowers and pushing around big lawn mowers. But yeah, that was my first job, getting into that business and seeing him run that and kind of build his life around it. So it was cool to see him do that.
I guess smart move on his part, cheap labor in the fact that number one, you're only 14 and number two, you're a family member. So
exactly.
I guess he probably wasn't paying award wages at that time, was he?
No, but I mean, to me, it was awesome, right? I was like, wow, I'm making some good money here.
What did you learn from that? I mean, you're watching someone else run a business. Was there anything that even at sort of age 14 that you kind of picked up from, you know, from business there?
Yeah, a couple things. One was, he was a hustler, so he was always working his ass off. He was, you know, as we were having jobs at places, he would go up to the neighbor's house and you know, chit chat and start to talk to people and let them know about his business. So from an early age, I saw, you know, how much hard work it really pays off and what it can lead to. And then I also loved his relationships that he created with his customers. He had customers that he had been working with for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years at a certain point. And it all came down to, you know, his relationship he built with them and making sure they were happy and really trying to create a personal relationship too. So those were two things that really stuck with me from that experience.
So after sort of working with him and seeing him, did that kind of give you the impetus to be starting your own business? Was that something that was sort of always in the back of your mind moving forward?
Yeah, it really did. And I actually started my own small business in my own neighborhood while I was working with him. I picked up some lawn mowing clients that I was able to work with and mow their lawns and kind of take care of their lawns during the summers. But then going into the falls, it was a lot of raking leaves and picking those up. And then after the winters, there would be kind of getting the lawns ready for the spring. So I was able to build a very small business, maybe 5 to 10 clients, but people that I was able to offer those service to as well.
So essentially going straight into competition with your cousin in a different part of the country.
Exactly. I took
his... How did he feel about that? Did he know about this, or, you know?
Oh yeah.
He didn't send some people around to see you, did he? Or...
No, he knew. They were all small accounts, so he wasn't too worried about it.
Yeah. Thank God for that. That could have been an awful
family
sort of
drama.
Family drama. Yes. Yeah. Connor's undercutting his cousin. So obviously there's a lot of other bits and pieces that you've done. I think one of the ones I wanted to touch on was you went to South Africa for 4 months. Can you kind of give us a bit of an understanding about what you did there and why you were there?
Yeah, of course. So I was a sophomore in university studying business, and the business school would randomly send out emails from time to time with internships and opportunities that students could look into. And one day, one came through with the subject, something along the lines of travel to South Africa for your summer. And I was a sucker for traveling. I hadn't done much of it, but I was always interested in it. And so I opened the email, and it was talking about this company called Think Impact, and their whole philosophy was taking college students from the US and also from other countries to impoverished areas of Africa, putting them into these rural communities, having them live with host families, and teaching them to build social businesses with the people there, with the hopes that when you left after those 4 months, 3 months, they would be able to take that business, carry it forward, and it would be able to benefit their community. So I did that in 2010 as an intern. And then I also went back in 2012 and ran the program that I went on in 2010. So I had two stints of going on this program with this company.
What sort of social businesses were they developing there?
Sure. So there was a number of them. A lot of them kind of focused around the main issues of the communities. So one of the biggest ones there is the HIV/AIDS, and also just the lack to clean water. Yeah. So there, like, what happened was there were about 12 of us that were on this trip, and then you split up into groups of like 3 or 4, and then you worked with some community members. So some people, you know, got together with like a group of women from the community, and they set up a farming co-op where they set up farmland. They were starting to grow vegetables, and then they would sell those to the community, and it made them profits, but then it also helped the community eat healthier. So it had that kind of social aspect, and it brought together women in a place where they were comfortable, you know, being with each other and kind of congregating. So there was a number of different projects that had to do with those types of things.
When you're dealing with those kind of businesses impoverished, you know, third world. I mean, there's a lot of people would argue whether South Africa is third world or not third world, but, you know, but we're talking, you know, obviously poor, impoverished communities.
Yeah.
And aside from the average, you know, aside from the obvious things when it comes to business, were the people that you were talking to, did they have a grasp of how to build a business, or were you really just sort of, you know, starting from scratch? Did you find people who had that kind of entrepreneurial spirit still within those communities?
Yeah, so there absolutely were. There were definitely some people that stood out after living there who were very interested in building businesses. And there were a number of people who had built their own businesses. There was an individual who, since these communities where I was living, they didn't have access to running water. There was a individual who had two trucks, and he set up a business where if people paid him, he would bring their jerry cans down to the closest place to get water. He'd fill them up, he'd bring them back, and he'd deliver them. So there were people that had that entrepreneurial mindset, and we were able to kind of help accelerate them, help to give them new ideas and kind of push them forward with things that they were thinking about.
Somewhere obviously in that transition, looking at your history, you got an interest in web development. Was that something, again, that you've always had? Because, I mean, I guess you weren't doing a whole lot of web development in those communities in South Africa, but...
Right, yeah.
Where did that sort of spike from?
Yeah, sure. So my father was an engineer. He worked for General Electric for most of his life.
Right.
And so from a young age, I did have access to a computer, which was awesome. I always loved that. I wasn't doing programming at a young age, but I would, take apart old laptops he would give me, put them back together, download different programs, try to use them. So I was always interested in computers and then the internet as it came about. But I didn't really get into building a business focused on the internet until I was in college, about my third year. And I ran into my business partner, who I actually continue to work with today. He was starting to buy textbooks from students on campus and then sell them on Amazon.com here in the United States.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and this was like 2009. So Amazon was really ramping up, but it wasn't as big as it is today here. And so there was a big opportunity. He was starting to test it. He invited me to help him out. And we really started to get involved in that whole world.
That's one of the basic steps of Amazon is getting something, buying something from someone else and then reselling it onto Amazon. What sort of, back then, what sort of profit were you making on a textbook?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it was probably between 30 and 40%.
Okay.
But it really depended on the actual book too. So, we had to haggle with students to try to get a good price. And then we'd go on Amazon, we'd look at what it was being listed at, and usually we put it at a pretty competitive price so we could get the sale.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it was closer, sometimes the margins were bigger, but on average, I would say between 30 and 40%.
Were you doing a lot? Was it like a couple of books a week, or were you shifting hundreds of books a week?
It got to hundreds of books a week. It also came in waves. So one of the big reasons students would sell their textbooks to us is because they would buy them from the bookstore for like $200.
Yeah.
And then they'd go back and the bookstore would offer them $10. So we were like, all right, we'll give you 20 and then you have an extra $10.
and bookstores are wondering why they went out of business back then, eh? That's
right. So it eventually got to a point where our dorm rooms were just piled with all these textbooks and we were listing them, shipping them out, trying to figure out how to get rid of them.
What was some of the things that you learned back then in terms of, I mean, I guess that must have been a relatively steep learning curve doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. So one thing I remember is one of the first tasks that I had in managing the Amazon business was understanding how to manage the inventory. So we'd have, all these books in our dorm room. And one of the things you had to do was you had to find the right listing on Amazon where that book was being sold and then list your book onto there to show that it was available for sale and you could ship it to people in the United States. So I would take those, I'd try to put them up, I'd make sure that the inventory was right and manage everything. Like you said, it was a huge learning curve. That was only one tiny bit of the business. On top of, you know, everything else from shipping to customer service to returns and refunds and everything that has to do with Amazon. So yeah, a lot of learning lessons there.
How do you find, I'm going to skip right forward now, just because whilst you're talking about that, it's a pertinent question, but how do you find Amazon now versus back then in what that was 2013, 2014? How has it evolved as a platform?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. So we started in 2009, that's when we were selling textbooks.
Right.
And then 2010, 2011, 2013, 2014, we started selling other products. We were selling toys and baby products and home goods because a lot of parents were coming onto the site and looking for products and really buying into what Amazon was selling. And so back then there was a lot less competition. There wasn't as many people selling.
I can imagine.
There wasn't the Amazon Prime program, which allows you to get 2-day shipping and it's shipped right from Amazon's warehouse. They didn't have all of those warehouses set up. So that wasn't even really a part of the equation. Whereas today, to run the business model that we were, it's definitely more difficult because there are so many people that are using Prime that you want to actually ship your products to Amazon's warehouses and then they ship it to the customer so that you can take advantage of the 2-day shipping and other incentives that they offer. So the whole game has really transformed, and there's a ton more people that are trying to sell as well.
It's interesting that you say that because we're recording this on Friday, the 20th of April. I believe Jeff Bezos sent his letter out to his shareholders, his annual letter out yesterday, day before that. Mm-hmm. I think he announced there was 100 million Prime members now or something like that.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Which is insane when you think about it in terms of, because it's a subscription service for those of you, and certainly in Australia, Connor, the Amazon market is very, very new. In fact, Amazon only arrived here, I think about 6 months ago, which
is
just before Christmas. Yeah. Which a lot of people can't believe. So the idea of Amazon Prime is quite alien to a lot of people, for those of the people that are listening in Australia. But those kind of, that sort of numbers are huge. That's 100 million subscriptions, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just wild. They've really taken the US by storm. And I mean, any person that's trying to sell online now in the US, you have such high expectations from your customers because of Amazon. You know, it's like, oh, I have to wait a week to get this. Like, that's how people are like pissed off about that. You know what I mean?
Well, it's funny you say that because I have a friend who lives in San Francisco, and he's originally from Australia. He's been in San Francisco four or 5 years now, something like that, maybe a bit longer. And he says, the thing that gets you eventually with Amazon is the 2-day shipping. He said, it's not so much the low prices, it's the fact that, you know, you order something on Monday and it's there on a Wednesday. He said, that is the real attractive part of the business model. Is that something you'd agree?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the speed is huge.
I
would say the prices when they started, like when we were selling on there, they did definitely undercut a lot more and they were much lower. But you could find better prices at other places today. But it's really just that reliability of 2-day shipping that just blows people out of the water.
Let's sort of move on to some of the, I want to obviously look at the big job. Obviously, you've got a few jobs, but there's probably the key one is this. With Portlight, so the co-founder, chief executive officer of Portlight. Do you want to give us an idea about what Portlight does?
Yeah, sure. So Portlight is what became from us selling textbooks. And it really, so we moved away from just selling textbooks.
Sorry, and I'm going to interrupt you there because there was a question I meant to ask you last time because you said you moved away from textbooks. How did you then pick your next category? Yeah. What something you said toys, you said kind of pet, you know, those kind of, what was it that sort of made you go, let's start selling toys?
Yeah, it was really Amazon. So they decided to expand into toys and baby products.
Right. So you went where they went.
Okay. We went with them and so there wasn't a lot of competition at all. And we were really able to really tap into that market. And especially here during the holidays, toys just fly off the shelves. It's like it could be anything and people are buying it. So that was a big reason for those ones. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So back to the history of Portlight then.
Yeah, sure. So we decided to stop selling textbooks because we really hated actually having the products. It was really annoying to find the right book that someone had bought, put it into a box, bring it to UPS, ship it to the customer, handle returns as people didn't want the book or they, you know, whatever it was. So we just, that was a lot of a hassle for us. And so we eventually kind of discovered this new business model of drop shipping, which is where you find a manufacturer or a brand. So someone who's already building their own product and maybe selling it to a retailer. You find them and you get them to give you permission to sell the product online somewhere. So ours was obviously through an Amazon store.
Yeah.
And then as we get sales, we send them the purchase order. They put it into the box, ship it to the customer, and then we handle any customer service afterwards. So we discovered that, and that was really where we then started to continue to build the business.
Just on a drop shipping 101 for people out there, and I know, I think the world lives, the world falls into two parts: those who understand drop shipping and those who don't.
Right.
What's the benefit for the manufacturer? Why would the manufacturer allow you to do that?
Sure. So in our specific case, it was because we had developed a knowledge base and expertise within selling on Amazon, and no one in their current team knew how to do that. It was very new. They were just focused on making the product and selling it to retailers like physical stores. And so we almost became like another arm of their business to help them get more sales on Amazon.
Is that still the same today with drop shipping? Is there still a lot of manufacturers out there who don't understand how to sell online and just want to sort of palm that off on somebody else?
The landscape has definitely changed. I would say that more manufacturers today have people within their staff that understand e-commerce and Amazon and the different channels a lot better. So some of them will even sell directly themselves through Amazon or through their own online store. But there are a decent amount of manufacturers who still will drop ship. It very much comes down to the manufacturer's decision as like a business, because if you're taking orders one by one, you need more people in your warehouse to handle that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a larger company and you can just demand purchase orders of at least, you know, let's say 500 units, then I think that's more advantageous to a manufacturer. So it kind of depends on where they're at and what they're trying to do with their business.
If you're working with a drop shipping, if let's say there's somebody out there listening to this and tomorrow they want to start a drop shipping business, what sort of margins would they be expecting to make through a drop shipping company?
Yeah, so we usually saw between 15% and 30% margins. Okay. So it's definitely a little bit lower than normal wholesale margins.
Yeah.
But that's because the manufacturer has a little bit of more work and you're not really, you know, you're not guaranteeing them any sales. Whereas if you bought 500 units, that's money in their pocket immediately.
Yeah.
So it kind of varies between 15% and 30%, I would say.
But I guess the flip side is that from a manufacturer's point of view, if they were trying to sell into a retailer, the retailer would probably want to buy their product and double the price before they sold it out at the other end. Mm-hmm. So selling to you is probably a more profitable, or dropshipping to you is a more profitable business model to them than it is to selling to a bricks and mortar retailer at the other end.
Exactly. Yeah, they control the price more because they have control over being able to ship it to the customer.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Whereas if they were going to go to a retailer, then the retailer has more bargaining power.
If you said in the blurb for Portlight that there's two distinct models that function on the Amazon marketplace, is that still the case? And what are those two models?
I would say there's more than two today.
Okay.
Back then it was drop shipping and wholesaling.
Right.
Today those two still exist. And then there's also FBA, which is Fulfillment by Amazon, which is kind of become its own. where you're buying products in bulk, but you're then using Amazon to ship the products to the customer.
Right.
So that's kind of a little bit of a variation. And then there's another one that's called private label. And this is like, you know, let's say you or I have a water bottle we like. We find someone that manufactures water bottles and they give us the permission to put our own name on it. So Connor Gill then water bottles, I then go sell those on Amazon.
Right.
So yeah, so that's a slightly different one too, but it still involves either drop shipping or wholesaling at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of a combination of a few different models in there.
Yeah.
What do you think, what to you is the, what's the preferred model to you these days?
So if I was to start a Amazon business today, I would definitely go with Fulfillment by Amazon as my fulfiller. And yep. The biggest thing is to tap into that prime market. Like we just said, 100 million people. Those are the people that are shopping the most. They're probably repeat customers. They go to Amazon for everything. Yeah. If you could find a niche in there and really dominate on a niche of products, that could be a great business.
And talking about those niche products at the moment, where do you think that is at the moment? Is there, I mean, obviously I don't want you to give away all of your trade secrets. Mm-hmm. But if there's people out there going, you know, I want to start a business, I've got the time, I've got the energy, I've got the money, you know, Amazon's a great channel. What's a good product category for them to be looking at these days?
Yeah, so it's hard to say a specific product category because you can go so deep within each category.
Yeah.
But my suggestion would be there's a lot of tools out there that work specifically at researching products through Amazon. So you can get these tools. Some of them are free. Some of them are, you know, maybe like $10 per month. And it gives you access to this big database of all of Amazon's products.
Oh, okay.
And then you can really break them down and like niche out different types of products and see what the competition is like. You can see how many FBA sellers there are. You can see what the prices are. You can see who the actual manufacturer is. So those can be really useful to do your research at first to try to find opportunities through Amazon where you may be able to come in and kind of carve out that niche.
Are you able to recommend any of those tools or any one that you might use or anything like that?
I can't think of the names of them right now, but because I haven't That's used cool. them in a little while, but I can send them over to you once we're finished, and then you can include them in the show notes.
Perfect. And we'll add again. Yeah, we'll put them in the show notes. That'll be great. Cool. So obviously, Portlight's still running. You're still involved in that on a day to day basis.
So it's not. We actually decided to stop that business about a year ago, as we were transitioning to a new business and we were seeing a lot of success, we decided to really put our full efforts behind that. So I don't
run Portlight anymore. That would be Free Up?
Yep. Yeah, that one's Free Up. And we started that one about 3 years ago.
Okay. And I guess Free Up was born out of the fact that sort of within that, within Portlight, you used a lot of, I'm guessing a lot of freelance staff within that? Or outsource stuff?
Yeah, exactly. So as in the 5 years or so that we were running Portlight, we were growing, we were working with more suppliers, we were managing a couple hundred thousand products through our store. Yeah. And we needed people to help us, you know, list those products, manage them, handle the orders, do the customer service, find new suppliers. So there was kind of a number of tasks that we needed help with in the business. And we hired some full-time employees. We hired some part-time employees. We had an office set up. And then we kind of discovered this whole world of outsourcing and finding people from some people even from the U.S. that were just on a freelance basis, but also people from like the Philippines and other countries where outsourcing was more common. And we were using websites like it's Upwork today, but it used to be Odesk and Elance.
Yes.
And there's like Fiverr.com, which is a popular one. All these are all marketplaces where you could hire freelancers.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were going to them. We were posting a job saying we needed someone to help us with Amazon listing. We'd get 10 to 20 applicants and we'd interview them. We'd you know, kind of try to narrow them down and then hire the right person. And we just kept running into a lot of turnover. You know, we found a great group of people. We had around 35 freelancers at a certain point that we were really happy with, but it took us about 3 years to find that group of people. And going through that turnover really left a sour taste in our mouth. And that's when we came up with the idea for FreeUp. You know, could we ourselves put together a group of pre-vetted freelancers that could help other Amazon sellers to grow their business so they wouldn't have to spend so much time like we did?
Right. I got to say, I mean, I've used Upwork on and off over the last 3-4 years. Mm-hmm. And I find it it's a needle in a haystack kind of service. There's good people in there, but it's finding them that's the big problem. I guess that's the major difference for you, is that you've already literally pre-approved all the people working on FreeUp.
Yeah, exactly. So today, and like I said, it's been about 3 years. Today we have about 1,000 freelancers that have gone through our application, interview, and testing process, and they've come out as the top 1%. So
okay,
that's how we do it. Anyone that wants to apply and offer their services, whereas on like Upwork, you know, anyone can create an account. For us, they have to go through this process that usually takes between 2 and 3 weeks to get into the network, and then we take the top 1%.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what I really like about your platform is that when you look at the pricing, it's really transparent. You know, for example, if you want a graphic designer, you're paying a non-US anywhere between $7 and $30, and you're paying a US person $20 to $35. There's very little ambiguity there. And I know that's kind of the same on Upwork, but again, then you've got to do all the interviewing and all that yourself. So that seems a much more attractive model that I think you've generated there. How's that performing for you at the moment in terms of growth of that business?
Yeah, we've seen really good growth. I mean, the first year, I think as with most businesses, we're really figuring everything out and putting together the pieces and understanding, you know, who's going to be attracted to this and how do we actually vet properly and set up a good process and how do we price everything and, you know, all those steps that you have to go through to start a business. And then in year two, we saw a lot of great growth. We created some awesome relationships with people in the Amazon and e-commerce industry that had large communities of sellers and e-commerce store owners that were looking to hire people. And they came in as clients for us. And so that was awesome. And then in this past year, we've seen a lot of expansion outside of e-commerce as well, starting to work with digital marketing agencies and coaches and consultants and software companies and lawyers and doctors. So it's been a good ride so far. It's really been a lot of fun to see where we could take this.
When you were growing that business, sort of day one, maybe that first year, mm-hmm. what was working for you in terms of building awareness of the business? How were you? What sort of channels were you using to grow that traffic?
Yeah, sure. So the first year was a lot of trial and error. We honestly used social media a good amount, and we were finding communities where people may be interested in our expertise within Amazon, and then also the idea of hiring Amazon freelancers. And in that first year, we didn't just have the marketplace. So that was one thing that we were offering on top of Amazon consulting and also a course of how to sell on Amazon. So we brought in a lot of our first customers through the consulting and through the course.
Right.
And we tried to show them a really great experience. We tried to, you know, kind of prove our worth and get them to trust us as individuals. And then when we mentioned that we also had this awesome group of Amazon freelancers we had used in the past, people started to get interested. And towards the end of that first year, we really saw the idea start to bloom, and a lot of the customers were most interested in hiring the freelancers. And that's when we fully switched over to just being a marketplace and trying to go in that direction.
Right. Right. Okay. I guess that's, yeah. I mean, I guess you've had a benefit from the fact that you had Portlight and you had a database of clients and customers through that, that you could gradually switch over to a different platform.
Yeah, definitely. And just the experience of selling on Amazon, it allowed us the ability to talk to these people, talk their language. We could understand that we had similar experiences. You know, you could kind of create a connection there and show that you were, someone that was in the industry, someone that was looking to build a new business that was helping people. And they could see that we were really trying to build something good, and they saw our experience and could connect to that. So that helped a lot as well.
What other channels still work well for you? Where do you find that most of your traffic comes from?
Yeah, so one of the biggest ones is our referral network. So we have about, right now we have about 5,000 businesses signed up using the network.
Yeah.
And we pay businesses 50 cents for every hour billed to anyone they refer forever.
Okay.
So we've seen, that's been huge for us. We show people a good experience. They post it out to their communities, their social media. They tell their friends, they tell other business owners. And then those people come in, and that kind of referral program just keeps replicating with each person that's in there. So that's been awesome for us. We've also seen a lot of traffic from going on podcasts like yours and just talking about our story and kind of sharing the service and putting ourselves out there as a brand that could be a good solution for people.
Yeah.
So that's been really great. And then another big way has been partnerships. So we'll find coaches or businesses that are focused on helping entrepreneurs grow their business, either from the ground up or, maybe once they've reached a certain point, they're helping them, set up different systems and processes, whatever it may be. And we partner up with them and create content with them. So we'll maybe create a video about, how to outsource or the important aspects of outsourcing. And then those people refer those customers to us. So those have been probably three of our best traffic generation tactics so far.
I can't sort of stress the partners one enough to people. I think your experience there, I have a friend stroke colleague who built and sold a similar kind of business to Free Up called Staffberry. Which was a outsourced company finding people in the Philippines, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he, one of his key channels for growing that business was partners. And he'd said, and I might be misquoting him slightly here, but who cares? I know he wouldn't. he said he always had a list of 20 key partners that they were working with.
Mm-hmm.
And if one of those partners sort of, stop referring them people or became less interested, they would take them out and try and replace them with another partner, so that they always had 20 key partners on a whiteboard in their office that said, these are the people that are going to be referring business to us. And that was the goal for them, was to have 20 key partners, each sending them leads every week or every month and that kind of thing.
That's awesome. I really like that goal. I mean, partners have been great for us. The secret is you just find companies that you're not directly competing with, but that have the audience that is the perfect target for you. And ideally, your community is perfect for them too. And you can just, send each other customers and build a relationship as being great partners. Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, this is one from my own personal business when it comes to, digital marketing for people, working with people that are, business strategists or creative people, because I'm not sort of stepping on their toes in their business, but, they're happy to refer me and I can refer them back as well. Other things like accountants and stuff like that, but that's a perfect opportunity. Just as a sort of side note on that, how do you find is search engine optimization? I mean, I know obviously you guys must know the Amazon search engine like the back of your hand. Does Google search engine optimization send you a lot of traffic?
Yeah, it does. So we produce about 3 blog articles per week, and then one guest article per week.
Yeah.
And we're always trying to build more links back to the site. So I think right now about a quarter of our traffic to the site is from or organic from SEO. So it's a good amount. It does a great job for us, and we're always trying to continue to improve it. It's just, it's a long-term consistent game. It's not something that's going to, you know, blast traffic to your site overnight, but if you're consistent with it and you do the right keyword research, it can be really useful over time.
Yeah, I find SEO is a struggle for smaller businesses. It's a struggle to explain because they want sort of results tomorrow because they need sales or they need bookings or something like that. But the best result I've had probably in the last 18 months was with a small IT company that we sort of, you know, optimized the pages, got a great website built. It was fast. Nice. It was a nice website. We produced not a lot of content, certainly not 3 articles a week. But to be honest with you, in the IT company space, anyone producing content is a novelty.
Is a winner. Yeah.
Not the most, the IT companies tend to not be the most sort of forward thinking when it comes to the content space. But yeah, just producing like 1 or 2 blogs a month, and getting those out there, that's where I kind of find, the success. SEOs, at the end of the day, you're competing against other businesses rather than competing with Google. So who would you be competing with out there on that sort of, in the SEO space? Upwork obviously would be one.
Yeah. Upwork's a big one.
Fiverr,
freelancer.com. Yeah. There's a bunch. There's called guru.com, 99 designs, people per hour. There's a ton out there. Yeah.
Bloody 99 designs. Anyway, I just, lots of history with 99 designs.
Oh boy. Every time I say that, someone always has some comment like that. It's very interesting.
I'm not a graphic designer, right? I've never, my father has a background in design, typesetting back in his day. And I'm not a graphic designer, never really used the Adobe products. I could do a bit of Photoshop at a push. Probably the best, like, you know, change the brightness or the contrast. My Photoshopping skills are about as good as my Instagramming skills. That's the way I could change a photo.
Nice.
But whenever I saw people who were working on 99 designs or seeing brands created on 99 designs, I used to go, every single one of those logos looks like it's been produced on 99 designs. There's something about it that just goes, there's like a 99 designs farm that's just producing these logos that all have the same kind of look and feel, and you know, they're fine to a certain degree, but if you want real personality and if you want a real brand that actually speaks about who you are and who your business is, you need to sit down with someone in front of them and talk to them.
Yeah, agreed. And explain to them, you know, this is what we value, this is what we're trying to portray.
Yeah.
Completely agree.
And when I say sit down in front of them, I don't necessarily say physically sit down in front of them, but whether it's a Skype call,
have a
conversation. Someone that can really understand who you are. You know, agreed. So anyway, that's my, that, there we go. There's my winch about 90.
There's your bet.
Okay. So in terms of the growth of FreeUp, that's all going well and everything. You're also an author as well. I saw you've got, it's my second author in a row. So tell us a little bit about your, the book that you've written.
Yeah, sure. So the book, which is called FreeUp Your Business, 50 Secrets to Bootstrap $1 Million Companies, is about a lot of what we discussed today. It follows the story from my beginning and my business partner's beginning up to about where we were a year and a half ago. And it offers 50 pieces of advice that we had learned going through building those businesses and kind of how we approach them. And we give a lot of, in the book, I give a lot of personal stories of, you know, how that lesson applied to us in that business, so that people reading could really see it and relate it to their business, hopefully as well.
How long did it take you to write the book?
It took me about, I think it was like 9 months like beginning to end. And the way we did it was...
So it's a proper book then. It's not like a, you know...
Yeah.
I see sometimes you download an ebook or a book and you find that it's got 8 pages in it. And you think that's a bit disappointing.
Yeah, no, this has, I think it's like 250 pages, something like that.
Okay,
it's pretty,
wonderful.
Pretty lengthy. Wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Mine was 192
Nice.
You know,
it's a process, right?
Yeah, it certainly is that. I wrote it back in 2013, and I need to go back and rewrite it because a lot of the stuff in it is actually just completely unapplicable in today's marketplace. But I had an email yesterday, someone who downloaded it and said, I read it from start to finish and thought it was wonderful. And I was like,
nice.
Jesus, well, that's probably the first person in 6 years that's actually read it from cover to cover, awesome. Including myself. I know we've spoken about a lot of the things the experiences that you have, but give us a couple of other, is there a couple of other key tips that you would mm-hmm. say to people who are either thinking of starting a business already in a sort of e-commerce business space?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So a big philosophy of both mine and my business partners has always been to stay focused on what we personally do best. And I think that's something that business owners and entrepreneurs stray away from at first because there's so much going on and there's so many things you're trying to do to grow the business.
Yeah.
But my encouragement is, you know, once you reach a point where your day is full of things on your plate, really start to value your time at a bit of a higher level and figure out which areas of the business you're, you know, one, most passionate about, and two, where you drive the most growth or where you add the most value. And then try to surround yourself with people that complement your skill sets and that like the other parts of the business that you don't necessarily like working on or that you're not great at. My business partner and I are very different. We, you know, he's great at some things that I really don't like to do, and I do other things that he just has no idea what I'm talking about. But it's okay because we have a good relationship of trust. We know where we want to head with the business, but we really wouldn't be able to do it without each other because of our different and complementary skill sets. So that's one of them. One thing to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. And I think where I've fallen down in the past is working with people who aren't sort of filling in the gaps that I've got, because I think that's a really important part of the business. From an e-commerce point of view, what are some of the tips that you would, a couple of key tips that you would give out from people running e-commerce businesses?
Yeah, sure. So for people, you know, maybe just starting out, let's kind of start there. For people who are just looking to build their first e-commerce business, there's a few decisions that you have to make as you're getting started, and those will really determine where the business goes over the first, you know, 6 months or so. So one of them is something we were talking about, you know, earlier, two of them actually. So the first one is, where are you going to sell? There's so many different places you could sell. You could sell on Amazon, you could sell on eBay, you could build your own online store and sell through there.
Yeah.
So you kind of need to make a decision on that and then figure out what it takes to do that. And then the second one is, you know, which business model are you going to use? Are you going to, you know, put some money out up front and try to buy some products to sell through your store? Or are you going to try to go the dropship way and, you know, not spend too much money up front and test out some different products and see what you're able to sell?
Yeah.
So those two decisions are big and you kind of have to figure those out. And then depending on which way you go, you know, let's say you're going to build your own website and sell products through there. In that situation, you need to think about marketing and advertising as well. Whereas if you're just selling on Amazon or eBay or another marketplace, they really handle the marketing for you. They're bringing customers to their site. You then need to figure out how you can price your products well and kind of keep competing with the other people there to get more sales. So it's really two different worlds in within e-commerce, depending on which decisions you make at the beginning.
Do you think... I've got a client who's an established e-commerce business. We handle their search engine optimization. We handle their AdWords, and they're in a very, very competitive marketplace. Mm-hmm. But they also do Amazon and eBay, which we're not involved in helping them. Mm-hmm. Is it? Do you think it's a good idea that an e-commerce business sells in multiple channels, or do you think they should just be focusing on one channel?
I think they, so from my experience, I think you should focus on one to start.
Okay.
And once you have a good formula down for that, yep, and you're seeing, you know, you're seeing good profits, you have a team built out and it's really running at a high level, at that point, you can then try to duplicate the system by going somewhere else. But to try to sell everywhere at first, I gotcha, think you're spreading yourself a little too thin.
Just, I've got a technical question. Is there, from looking at Amazon or eBay or your own e-commerce, do you find that when you're working with customers from a technical perspective that they don't focus on those technical aspects of their website, like the speed of the website or how well written things like descriptions are, or is that a failing you see, or is that something that people tend to get right?
I think it's a factor. I think, are you asking if customers mind it or if
That's probably a better one. Do customers mind that things like titles aren't well written, or you know, that the descriptions aren't
long enough.
Or that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think it does play a factor. I think just because of where the e-commerce industry has gotten to, again, like I was saying earlier, the expectations have risen. Maybe 5 or 10 years ago, you could have gotten away with just having a picture of your product and having a good price and people would be interested in it. But today it's really important to have good titles, have good copy, you know, have multiple pictures, have it all optimized for mobile since a lot of people are on their phones these days. I think those small details that maybe weren't as important 5, 10 years ago can be a big factor today, and it can turn people off because if they see even like a typo, maybe they lose trust just a slight bit and then they don't want to go through that checkout process. There's so many like mental things that people go through when they're buying. You want to try to be as perfect as possible.
That trust element is really important. I think the more competitive a particular channel gets or the marketplace gets, eroding that trust just for one second can have a devastating effect on, you know, the ongoing numbers of sales, especially if you're dealing with a lot of traffic as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's another like piece of advice. So I see a lot of people who just start e-commerce companies or have been doing it for a little bit. They'll reach out to me through social media and, ask me to just take a look at their site and kind of provide some feedback. And I think a big thing that a lot of people miss out on is trying to almost like have a story, have something that people could relate to when they come to your site. E-commerce isn't just about having products that people can buy. They want to know like who's on the other side of this store, right?
Yeah.
You know, show a little bit about yourself, give them a reason to trust you and to give you their money through the internet and kind of hope that you're going to actually ship them the product. I think it's tough if you just go completely anonymous and people can't really relate or find any way to trust you.
If you go back and have a look at one of the my earlier interviews with a company called Vinomofo, who are online order wine ordering business.
Okay, cool.
They have a mission statement or an about us page that is close to War and Peace. It's like it's a long, long page. There is a lot of information in it. But that was the key for them, was that telling that story about who they were was so important that's how the brand got built, and that's why people love them so much and so on. So one last sort of question in your space before we do the sort of final three questions. Drop shipping sources, and I know we could probably have two hour long, even longer discussion about whether to buy from China or not to buy from China, or what, you know, just what's your advice to people if they're looking for those kind of manufacturers and outsourcing? Should they be spending, you know, a couple of days on Alibaba? Is there a better way to find manufacturers? What would you suggest?
Yeah, great question. So I personally don't have a ton of experience with Alibaba. I know a lot of people have had a lot of success there, and it's definitely become more popular, I would say, within the past 5 years, since they've made their marketplace a lot more accessible and easier to search and everything. the way that I did it and we did it with our business was we first went to other websites and found products that we saw an opportunity for and we saw that we wanted to sell. And then usually on other sites, you can see who makes that product.
Right.
So you take that person's name, which is usually the manufacturer.
Right.
You search it on Google.
Yeah.
You find that manufacturer's website. And then you find their wholesale department. And that's where you want to contact. You reach out to them by phone or by email. And you just shoot them a quick message saying, hey, I'm interested in buying your products.
Yeah.
That doesn't say that you're trying to drop ship. And it doesn't turn them off from that. And usually, you know, the wholesale department's job is to get more sales for their products.
Yeah.
So they're going to respond to you and reach out to you. And then at that point, you can, you know, you kind of tell them about yourself and try to build a little bit of trust and then see if they're open to drop shipping.
Yeah.
So that's how we saw the most success was doing kind of targeted research and then getting in touch with those wholesale departments.
What sort of categories was that in?
That was like toys, baby okay. products, and home yeah. goods. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, final three questions. What are some of the, what's a brand that you really like, that you admire, that you buy frequently, that you sort of, you know, mm-hmm. try and follow?
Yeah, so Nike is a okay. brand that I really love. And I liked it growing up just because it was one of the more popular ones. But just recently I read the book written by Nike's founder. It's called Shoe Dog. And it's pretty much a memoir of his whole journey, finding the start of Nike, going through all the years of initially building it up, going to Japan and finding different manufacturers to make the shoes for him and kind of building it around the United States, then building it into an international brand. And I really respect him as an entrepreneur and all of the grit that he had to build up the brand. So that's one that I really respect and like what they do.
Cool. Any smaller brands that perhaps, you know, that you might have seen in, you know, either in Denver or you were originally from Florida, weren't you? Working in mm-hmm. Florida?
Yeah, I lived in Orlando for about 5 years.
Any small brands that you used to like in those kind of areas?
I'm trying to think. I did, so this one's random, but I used a company that was like a clothing company for a number of months. They're called 5-4 and they're a subscription model okay. where you give them your sizes, you give them your style, and they send you clothes every month kind of based off of what you're interested in. And I really yeah. liked their brand. They had built it up to be pretty good and they had a good following with their customers and everything. So that was one that I enjoyed working with and I recommend cool. it to people today for sure.
Is that's 5-4? Would that be the numbers, the letters, the words 5-4 in
yeah,
the brand?
Yeah, the words, yeah, 5-4 okay. spelled out, and okay. I think it's 54club.com. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Perfect. So, second to last question: what's next for you? Obviously, you're growing Free Up. Do you have any other sort of side projects on? Is there a side hustle from for you these days, or does sort of Free Up take up all your time?
So Free Up takes up a lot of time, and I'm really excited about continuing to grow the business. I'm very passionate about the whole freelance and gig economy that's just growing here in the United States, but all around the world. And my side hustle for the past couple of years has been my blog, where I write a couple articles
yeah.
every week or every month. But I am also thinking about right now potentially writing another book focused on the history, the present, and the future of the whole freelancing world and the gig economy. So that's something I might yeah. be diving into in the next couple of months, but it's very much in the discovery phase right now.
Do you think the gig economy is a good or a bad thing? Obviously, it gets a lot of press, and yeah. some of it's not always good because it's certainly here in the in Australia is that, you know, people talk about the gig economy as a problem for people, things like saving for the retirement and stuff like that, because, you know, there's no forced, we have something here called superannuation, which you wouldn't have in the US, but
right.
It's that kind of forced savings for the future. So do you think it's is it still evolving? Do you think the gig economy is going to change much?
I do think it's still evolving. I think we'll see a good amount of changes over the next decade. I personally think it's a good thing. I think it almost allows people to act as entrepreneurs without having to build out a full-blown company. You can offer a service and find a group of clients that really like you and work with them at a high level and build up your own income.
Yeah.
In terms of, it changing, I think one of the biggest things, especially here in the States, and I'm not sure what the laws are in Australia right now, but there's a very gray line between what is an employee and what is a contractor.
Yeah.
And yeah. The laws are just very antiquated, probably written, 100 or so years ago. So yeah. I think once they actually make new laws to address gig workers and freelancers, it will change things either for the better or for the worse. So yeah, I'm kind of interested to see what happens there.
Yeah, me too. It is a gray area here. There is a bit more. I think there's much more clarity here in Australia than there probably is in the US, but still it's a bit of a, there's still gray area there. Yeah. So, final question: if people want to come and ask you a question, if they want to, they want a piece of advice, mm-hmm. or just want to chat to you, what's the best place to track you?
Yeah,
down?
Sure. So I'm most active on Facebook and LinkedIn. So if anyone wants to connect with me, please do there. I'm pretty active, and I manage my own accounts. And then, like you said earlier, I have my own site, just ConnorGillivan.com, and there's ways that you can contact me there. And the best email is just Connor@FreeUp.com. And then if anyone wants to, check out what we're doing with FreeUp, visit FreeUp.com, and it is with 3 E's, so FreeUp.com.
Do you find you have to spell that out to everybody all the time?
We do. I do, just in case, because, I mean, if you didn't know, you would just type FreeUp.com. So,
I was going to say, what's free up with 2 E's? If people accidentally go there, is that safe for work website or anything?
So it's not. No one's using it. It's actually owned by Verizon. So they just have the domain. Right. Kind of tough one to get for us.
I bet the bastards want something like 7 figures for it as well.
Oh yeah,
they?
Yeah. We've been in talks with them, but their demands are a little bit too high for what we want to do.
I can only imagine. So, mate, look, Connor, that's been absolutely fantastic. I really, really appreciate your time. Well, it's this morning here in Australia. It's this evening in Denver, but appreciate your time. Appreciate your advice. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It was fun chatting. I enjoyed it, and I'm glad I got to be your first American guest. That's awesome.
Thanks very much. That's it for this week. Episode 24 of the Simon Dell Show is done and dusted and in the can. Thank you very much for tuning in. We will be back next week with more Spin Cycle, a new guest. Finally, once again, if you get a chance, please go and rate and review us on iTunes. We would really appreciate that. If you are listening to us on SoundCloud, you can do a little like thing, or you can follow us on SoundCloud, or whatever it is that SoundCloud does. And if you're listening to us on any other channels, I've forgotten that I put this on those channels. But thank you anyway, because that's most appreciated. So once again, we will see you next week.